Let's just cut to the chase. Let's go right where all the best analysis we can get in this country. What is the very best analysis available at any price? They said, well, Dave, that would be neutron activation. I said, okay, neutron activation it is. Where do we get it done? Well, you have to go to a government lab to get neutron activation, you know. So I find that most of the labs of the U.S. were all tied up for like a year and a half, 2 years in advance. So we found out that Harwell Labs over in London would do the analysis for us. So what we did is we burned our sample for 69 seconds, and just 1 second before it should start reading these elements, we turn it off. We take our knife and we dig out of the carbon electrode this little glowing white bead now that's gone black because it's cooled off. We dig it out, we put it in a bag, and we send it off to Harwell Laboratories. Now, we assume that this is going to some place where they do nuclear analysis. This has nothing to do with electrons way out on the outside. It has to do with the nucleus itself, the protons and the neutrons of the nucleus. And these guys send energy into the nucleus, and they read the resonance spectra of the nucleus itself. Now, this is absolutely certain to read this stuff, right? So we get a report back, and it says, no precious elements detected. Now this just really, really frustrates everybody. You say, my God, are we literally making these elements under this DC arc? Or is it that they exist in some other state that we don't know about? Now, the concept of having a change in the nuclear state never entered our mind. You know, it has to be something in the electron structure. And yet the nucleus doesn't read. And I decide, you know, enough of the spectroscopy. I know how much is here now. We've actually done quantitative analysis. Our analysis said that the material that we're starting with had 6 to 8 ounces per ton of palladium, 12 to 13 ounces per ton of platinum, 150 ounces per ton of osmium, 250 ounces per ton of ruthenium, 600 ounces per ton of iridium, and 1,200 ounces per ton of rhodium. Now, to give you some idea of what this means, the best known deposit in the world is now being mined in South Africa, where they go a half mile under the ground and they follow an 18-inch seam of rock, and they bring out this rock that contains one-third of 1 ounce per ton of all the platinum group elements. And our material contains in excess of 2,400 ounces per ton of the platinum group elements. And so, needless to say, the numbers are so preposterous, so absolutely ridiculous, that I said, you know, we got to pursue this further. We got to find out where it takes us. If it was 10 or 15 or 20 ounces per ton, I might have walked away from it. If it was 200 or 300 ounces per ton, I might have considered walking away from it. But this is 7,500 times better than the best known deposit in the world. You know, we got to find out what this is all about. So I went to this PhD analytical chemist that everybody said, if you can get this guy to do the work, he's the only certified expert witness in metallurgical separations in the state of Arizona. Now, this guy is the best you can buy. He's a PhD analytical chemist trained at Iowa State University, which is where the Department of Energy's metallurgical school is. So I went to this guy and I said, here's the Soviet text. In here it says, this is how to do quantitative chemical separations. Would you run the procedure for me? And he looked over my book, he looked over the references. I told him about my spectroscopic studies and showed them references in the book. And he said, Dave, I've heard this story all of my life about these precious elements, particularly the platinum group here in Arizona. You must understand, I'm a certified expert witness, and the only thing I have to sell is my credentials. If I charge you money, then I have to write you reports. And he says, I'm not comfortable doing that. So he said, but I'll tell you what I'll do. I will work for you at no charge at all until I can show you where you're wrong. And at that point, I'll sign a report and give it to you, and you pay me then $60 an hour for my time. I went, gee, you know, sounds fair enough to me. And so I started working with this guy, and he actually ran all the Bureau standards, weights and measures procedures. He ran the Soviet procedures. He actually bought standards and ran them in the procedures. Anyway, 3 years later, my bill was about $138,000, and he was kind of needing some money. And he says, Dave, I can tell you it's not any of the other elements on the periodic table. And I said, no, John, that's not enough. You got to tell me what it is. And he says, well, when I put commercial standards in or run it through the seizure, it separates where it's supposed to separate. But when I put your stuff in run it through the seizure, it separates just like it's supposed to. Except when I'm done, I've got 6 to 8 ounces of ton of palladium, 12 to 13 ounces per ton of platinum, 150 ounces per ton of osmium, 250 ounces per ton of ruthenium, 600 ounces per ton of iridium, and 1,200 ounces per ton of rhodium. And I said, well, what's the problem? I mean, it says this is exactly the same numbers as spectroscopy was telling us from another laboratory. And he says, well, Dave, when we take an element that's so conspicuous like rhodium, see the color of this sweatshirt she's wearing right here? That's the color of rhodium chloride solution. It's a very unusual color. Thank you. Rhodium got its name from the rose color of its chloride solution. It's a very unusual, very distinct color. It's a rose color. And so there's no other chemistry of anything other than possibly some shades of chromium are similar to this. But it's a very unusual color. You don't find it anyplace else. And there was no chromium in our ore. So anyway, he says, when I separate rhodium as pure rhodium, it looks just like that color. It's a gorgeous, you know, rose color. But when I neutralize the rhodium solution and it precipitates out of solution as a hydroxide, and I dry that at 850 degrees in a controlled atmosphere under oxygen, it forms an anhydrous dioxide. And it's red-brown, the very color it should be to be rhodium dioxide. And then I hydrogen reduce it, and the oxide leaves, and it's a gray-white powder, just like rhodium should be. But then I anneal it to 1,400 degrees, and it turns snow-white. And he says, Dave, I have no idea what this white stuff is. So I said, okay, what's the problem? And he says, well, at this point, in my formal education as a PhD chemist, I'm supposed to take these samples and send them for spectroscopic confirmation. And I said, well, it's pure rhodium. Let's send it for confirmation. He said, well, when I send the dioxide, they tell me it's iron. And he says, Dave, I know that this is not iron. You know, iron's a very common element. We work with it all the time. This is not iron. And I said, well, then what does the material after you hydrogen reduce it read to be? And he says, well, it automatically quits being iron, and now it's silicon aluminum. And I said, well, what's the white stuff? And he says, well, that's calcium and silicon. So our iron that had no silicon, no calcium, no aluminum, now becomes silicon aluminum, and now there's no iron, just by putting hydrogen gas on it. And he says, Dave, my life was so simple before I met you. Now, needless to say, this is taking years and years and years of work. I finally got involved with a Canadian partner who came in 1986, and they put up some money and said, we will monitor the work you're doing, and when we're totally comfortable that what you're representing in fact is so, then we'll put up the money to build your production facility, which I wanted to build after the studies were done. And so I said, look, we're going to use General Electric. General Electric actually has people back there who are building fuel cells out of rhodium and iridium. And they've actually bought rhodium and iridium to work with. They know the chemistries of it. So I said, we're going to take our stuff to them and have them do the evaluations of our rhodium and our iridium. And they said, good, we'll be your financial backer. We are backed by Legal and General Assurance in London, a $26 billion a year mutual fund. I said, okay, this looks like a real good arrangement. Everybody signed confidentiality agreements. Nobody could talk about it, and we just did our studies. But when we got back to GE, I talked with them, and they had told me, yeah, we did the fuel cells, and yeah, we know that the stuff doesn't analyze, and yeah, we know it explodes. I said, you've seen it? And they said, yeah, we've seen it. It explodes. I said, but it doesn't analyze. They said, well, when we get our stuff from Johnson Matthey, our rhodium and our iridium, it doesn't work well in fuel cells, so we put it into molten salt. And when we do, it doesn't analyze nearly as well as when we bought it. They knew this. And they said, so your material, you're saying, doesn't analyze at all. We don't have a problem with this. Now, keep in mind, these are people who build analytical instrumentation for a living, and they weren't following with it. I said, okay. So, anyway, by the time we got our partners involved and got the stuff produced and got it back to them, they had sold their fuel cell division to United Technologies. And United Technologies had the people come work for them for a few months, and then the people actually quit United Technologies and went and started their own study group called Giener Incorporated in Waltham, Massachusetts. And so Tony LeConte went with them to the head of their fuel cell division at Giener Incorporated. And so by the time I get back with my material, they're at Giener Incorporated. So I said, well, great. Now you can sign a confidentiality agreement where you won't talk to anyone about this, and we'll work with you. So we paid them to do the fuel cell studies. As received, the rhodium we sent them, the alleged rhodium is what they referred to it, or the rhodium substitute, didn't have any rhodium in it. They sent it for analysis, no rhodium in there. Then they mounted it on carbon, and when they do that, it goes black. And they put it into fuel cells, and they tested the fuel cells for about 3 weeks. And then after they did the 3 weeks of testing, they tore down their fuel cell and sent the electrode back for analysis. And now it analyzes to have 6 to 8% rhodium on it. The rhodium had mysteriously appeared from no place. Well, needless to say, they were very impressed, because rhodium sells for a lot more than platinum. Rhodium is quite valuable. It's a lot more valuable than gold. And here we were getting it from no place. It was mysteriously appearing. So they said, Dave, it's our opinion that nobody understands this. Big revelation here, you know. And I says, yeah. And they said, well, Dave, if you're the first one to discover it, if you're the first one to explain how to make it, then you can get a patent on this. And I said, nah, I'm not interested in patenting this. I'm not interested in that. And they said, well, come talk to our patent attorney in Washington, D.C. So I went down to Washington, D.C., and I figured, well, I'll just give him an hour or two to talk to me. And one of the things this patent attorney told me, he said, Dave, if you don't tell anybody about this in a patent, if you elect to keep it proprietary and secret, then if somebody else discovers it and they file for a patent on it, they actually can stop you from working with it. Now, that didn't sound right. But he said, that's the law. So I said, well, gee, maybe I do want to patent it after all. So in 1987, we filed U.S. and worldwide patents on orbitally rearranged monoatomic elements, or what we call ORMs for short. That was a name that we're flying on an airplane trying to come up with a name, and I said, this guy was with me, and he said, how about this? And I said, no. And he said, how about this? And he said, ORMs. And I said, yeah, that sounds good. Orbitally rearranged monatomic elements, ORMs. So we had ORM gold, ORM platinum, ORM palladium, ORM silver, ORM rhodium, ORM iridium, ORM ruthenium, ORM osmium. Anyway, we filed those patents in 1987, and the patent office really objected to this. They said, Dave, in your patent, you're not being specific enough about the weight of this material. And I said, well, the weight isn't constant. If you produce this stuff as the pure gray-white powder and you take it out of the tube furnace where it hits the air, it says wait for 2.5 minutes, then weigh it, and you wait 2.5 minutes and it's still gaining weight. You wait for 5 minutes, it's still gaining weight. The scales are continuing to increase, and you wait for 15 minutes, it's still gaining weight. And I said, where do you report the weight? What's the real weight of this stuff? And at what point you say, okay, this is it. This is the weight. They said, well, we've got to have some precise numbers. You can't have estimates. You can't have approximates. And I said, well, it depends on how long you wait. And he said, well, get something where you don't ever have a variable. And so I said, well, that means we've got to be able to heat it and hydrogen reduce it and then weigh it and never have it get out in the air. And so I asked the PhD chemist, I said, is there any machine that would allow us to do this? And he says, well, yeah, the most specific one you can get is called thermogravimetric analysis. And I says, fine, get one of those machines. He says, well, about $380,000. And I says, on second thought, don't get one of the machines. He says, but Dave, we can lease one for about $6,000 a month. I said, well, good. In 2 or 3 months, we could get all the studies done, and we'll send it back. He said, okay, we'll bring one in. So this is a machine that's all atmosphere controlled. It's computer operated. It's all atmosphere controlled. It has a microbalance reaction and put the sample in on the balance, and it weighs the sample while you oxidize it and hydrogen reduce it and anneal it, all while you're weighing it. It never comes out of the atmosphere, the controlled atmosphere. It actually is weighing it in the heating apparatus. I said, well, that's everything we need, right? So we bring this machine into town, we set it up, we start running this machine. So we oxidize it and it goes to 130%. We hydro reduce it, it goes to 103%. Now everything's so far so good. And then we anneal away the hydrogen and it goes to 56%. I said, wait a minute. It was 100% to start with. We went to 130% we oxidized, 103% we hydro reduce it, and now it's 56%? Did we volatilize away part of the sample? Did it vaporize due to the high heat? So we took this 50% of this white powder and we put it over on a quartz boat. And we weighed the quartz boat, we weighed the powder, we put it all on the quartz boat, and we heated it up to like 1600 degrees where it actually melted into the glass, the quartz. And when it melts into the glass, it turns black and all the weight comes back. So the mass never really left the sample. It just, when it was in there, you couldn't weigh it. This doesn't make any sense. I mean, this is not possible, right? So I said, well, let's do this again. Now let's oxidize it, let's hydrogen reduce it, and let's anneal it again, and let's turn it white. And sure enough, it went down to 56%. I said, well, let's cool it, and then heat it again, and cool it, and heat it again. Never take it out of this machine. And so when we start weighing it as we're cooling it, the weight goes to 350, 400%, down to 56%, 200%, down to 50%. It's jumping all over the place. I said, well, let's heat it again. So we, without ever taking it out of the machine, we start heating again. And it starts going less, and it goes like 20% of the weight. And then it will collapse back to 56%. So then we cool it down again. This time it goes 350, 400, 500%, and then collapse down to 56%, go up to a huge amount, then collapse down. And this is like over an hour and a half to 2 hours' time. It's floating. And I said, well, let's heat it again. So then we just heat the same sample again. And this is all under a total inert gas. And it literally goes to the point it weighs less than the pan weighs it's sitting in. In other words, if the powder wasn't in the pan would weigh zero. With the stuff in the pan, it weighs less than zero. And yet when you cool it back down, there the stuff is. It's never left. It's still 56% of the correct weight. But every time we heat it, it would go less than zero. And you know, when you look in there and look in the pan, it's not there. It's gone. The pan's empty. And yet when you cool it back down, it begins to form around the outside, and you see it solidify, and there it is again. We had no explanation for it, people. I mean, we were totally dumbfounded. So I went to the manufacturer of the machine, and they, by the way, they did give us magnetic standards that came to this machine. You can actually take a little salt crystal and put it in the machine, and you heat it, and at 250, 300 degrees, it would become magnetic. And then at like 650 or 700 degrees, it would lose the magnetism and go to a normal material. Then when you cool it back down at 650, it would become magnetic. 350, it would lose the magnetism. It was actually a standard that you put in your machine to check it, see if it was, you know, interacting with the magnetic material. When we put the magnetic material in, heat it and cool it, nothing happened. It weighed just perfectly. So it wasn't an interaction of the field of the heating machine with the sample. And yet we put this stuff in it, it didn't make any sense at all. I mean, it was crazy. It just, any weight you wanted, it seemed to be able to be weighed that way. So I go off down to Varian over in the Bay Area in California, who makes the machine, the Varian Corporation. And I said, look at this data here. It makes no sense at all. What's going on here with this machine? You know, it's got to be something you can explain, right?